Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is AppSats Radio, help for partners after sexual betrayal. We talk about it here.
Betrayal trauma.
We are AppSats certified clinical partner specialists and coaches who have been trained to help navigate you through this crisis. There is nothing we won't talk about.
So I've got Amy on the line. Amy, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Well, I have a question about what healthy sexuality looks like when a sex addict is in recovery.
One of the things we know about research and sex addicts is that they don't necessarily want sex with their own wife. And so to me, that says he's in really good recovery because he does want that with you. He has been 2 years sober. He has been in 3 facilities. And I suspect that's how he's wanting closeness with you.
And that is all she wrote. You know, it is so true that sex addicts are oftentimes, they want sex with their wives, but they're not able to have sex with their wives. And one of the reasons being is because they have trained their brain to be excited by different fantasies, by different thoughts, by different images. And so, you know, one of the things we're seeing with 20-year-old boys, 22-year-old college students is they can't become intimate with a woman because they've looked at so much pornography. As men get older, the sex addiction escalates. And that's when they may go to chat sites or adult websites or Craigslist, or they may visit massage parlors or prostitutes. My point is that this illness escalates. And so for some sex addicts, they really aren't able to enjoy the intimacy with their wife. I mean, how can you be intimate with somebody if you're living a lie, if you're hiding things from them, if you're managing 2, 3, 4 different lives? It just isn't going to happen. And so in Amy's case, her husband has done good recovery. He has been through several treatment centers. He is really working diligently on his program. He does attend a lot of 12-step meetings. He's doing a lot of recovery reading. I mean, he has just made it his own. He's figured out how to make recovery work for him. And because he has really focused on getting himself healthy, he really does want that relationship with his wife. And she's scared, understandably. She needs to feel safe and stable. But enough time has elapsed, she can begin to decide what are her sexual boundaries. How vulnerable can she really become? You know, what are her sexual needs? She's been married to this guy for over 20 years. So, she can begin to test the waters a little bit and see what feels safe for her. You know, in sexuality and healthy sexuality between couples, it's negotiation and compromise. And it certainly is that way with couples in recovery. But as I tell my addicts that I work with and their partners, really, after this kind of betrayal, the partner is in the driver's seat. She gets to decide what she needs, and she gets to decide how much of it she needs, whether that's frequency, whether that's intensity. That's what works for her. Hi there, I'm Carol Jurgensen. She's AKA Carol, the coach, and I am doing this radio show for AppSats. AppSats is the organization that trains partner-sensitive coaches and clinicians. So we're really happy to be with you today. Now, I got an email, and the email said, you know, 1 year ago from yesterday, my husband was diagnosed with a sex addiction. We've been married for 14 and a half years and together for 19. Needless to say, it's been hard to recover. This is especially the case because of how increasingly isolated, sad, confused, and angry I've progressively become throughout the entirety of our marriage. We've been in therapy, marital and individual, with a CSAT for a year. Now, that's a certified sexual addictions therapist trained through ITAP. We've also gone to intensives, two of them. However, I need something more. I feel like I should be further along in my healing. Instead, I steadily struggle physically, emotionally, psychologically, and socially due to isolation and fear. There are no groups offered for partners of sex addicts in my area, which happens to be Chattanooga, Tennessee. And I was wondering if there is a recommended online support group or other resources for partners. I've listened to your podcast and I love it, so I remember this being discussed, but don't recall the specifics. I'm now ready to do something more, and I really need help. My pain is now affecting my health and professional life more and more. This indicates to me that I need to change, but I really do feel stuck. If you can help that, it would be awesome. Thank you. And we'll call her Mary. Okay, Mary, this is what I would tell you to do. Go to appsats.org, and I would look through the directory and look for coaches or clinicians that have online support groups. Why? Because we are specifically partner-sensitive trained, and we know what you're going through. We know what it feels like to be stuck. We know when you want more. But we also know that there's probably a reason that you're scared to trust. So go to APSATS, that's APSATS.org, and look at the directory. And, you know, you'll see pictures of people. You'll see descriptions, what they have to offer. And I guarantee you that will likely help. However, if you don't get your needs met there, one thing I know for sure is if you go to btr.org, that's betrayaltraumarecovery.org, BTR. That is a website that is partner-sensitive too, and they employ only APSATS coaches and clinicians to provide online groups for them. So it's another really valuable website. And they only use APSATS coaches, and I know you'll get your needs met there too. So that is my recommendation, because you deserve to be unstuck. We know that to be true. You definitely deserve to have freedom from the pain that you have been suffering. And it can be very, very disheartening when you want to get healthy, and there's just something stopping you from making that happen. And that is what we're all about here. Because I really know, as does anybody who works, who's been trained by APSATS, that, you know, this is a process, it's a journey, and the more support you get from, you know, online groups, perhaps support groups, a partner-sensitive therapist, a partner-sensitive couples therapist, the intensives you talked about, the better you'll feel about making it through this journey, you know, and finding safety, as Barbara Steffens, our president, says, in an unsafe situation. Does that make sense? I certainly hope so, because it's all about your safety and stabilization. You know, one of the things that we really want to do is we want to help you to be able to do that, to feel safe, so that you can be vulnerable. Today's show is about vulnerability and intimacy after betrayal. And I've got Marie Krebs coming on, and she is an expert in intimacy disorders, partner betrayal, and vulnerability. As an APSATS-trained therapist, she believes it's important to educate betrayed partners about healthy intimacy. And so, you know, it's kind of like when I'm working with partners, they do want to know, when will I be able to trust? When will I feel close again? And, you know, addicts, when I'm working with them, they will say, you know, I really want to know, when can we resume healthy sexuality? Now, I get that. You know, healthy sexuality is important, but I say you got to do the emotional stuff first, first and foremost. So, Marie is going to be talking about the importance of personal growth and self-awareness, you know, getting you to the place where you can understand what your needs are and how you can move forward in your own journey. And that does start with self-growth. So happy to have her on the show because she is an amazing woman and has been doing this a long time. We're really lucky to have her with us today. So, without further ado, I am going to welcome Marie Krebs on the show so that she can talk about vulnerability and intimacy after betrayal. So, Marie, thank you for joining Betrayal Recovery Radio.
Well, thank you, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And I was so happy you wanted to talk about this topic because it is near and dear to the hearts of partners, you know, all over the world. Once they deal with the trauma of discovery and disclosure, and they're trying to figure out how to come back from this situation, they feel so vulnerable, and they know they're going to have to put themselves into more vulnerable spots if they're ever going to achieve intimacy. So can you share with me, first and foremost, how did you get involved with this work?
In terms of working with partners in particular, or working particularly in this kind of this field? I mean, I've been in this field for over 10 years here in Dallas, Texas. I was working, and I used to work at the largest recovery center in the Southwest. It was a facility referred to as the Center for Spiritual Development, CSD for short. And, you know, when I left, we had about 80 plus or minus 12 step recovery meetings every week. And the majority of those meetings, fellowships, recovery support meetings, were for sex addicts, sexaholics, sex and love addicts, partners, and then some other different fellowships. And part of the reason that I got into this work is I was you know, a therapist, and I was having, you know, people coming in, and so I got additional training in order to be able to work more effectively, both with treating the partner and with treating the addict. My work today is not as much with the addict as it is with the partners, and that's been more of my focus in the last several years. But this idea of vulnerability and intimacy, and actually I was preparing for a presentation I'm giving in Austin in a couple of weeks, and so for me, that it was that intersection between vulnerability and intimacy, and then it occurred to me one day this notion of how self-aware we are, self-awareness. And I don't know about you, Carol, but I can imagine if you or I walked into either a restaurant full of people or a movie theater and we got everyone's attention and we asked for a show of hands, how many people in that space feel like they're pretty self-aware? I mean, it would be my guess that most hands would go up, right?
Absolutely, right.
Because
you would think.
Because most of us think that we are pretty self-aware. And the reality of it is we're not nearly as self-aware as we would like to think that we are. And hence the reason that, you know, oftentimes we will find ourselves in these relationships with, you know, people that we feel like we've been living with a stranger, you know, because of, you know, either discovery or disclosure or, you know, a variety of things. And so so this topic is really, it's important to me because, you know, you're right. Regardless of where somebody is on their, you know, path of healing, in order to be, you know, in a healthy and whole relationship, you have to be able to be vulnerable in order to experience true intimacy.
Well, absolutely. And you even have some ideas, you know, it's kind of like, what is intimacy? What is vulnerability? And you have some myths about,
yes.
Can you share with me some of the myths about vulnerability?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. You know, the very first myth about vulnerability is that it's weakness. That, you know, if I'm vulnerable, I'm being weak. But the truth of the matter is it's the most accurate measure of courage. Another myth about vulnerability is that you can opt out, that, you know, that you don't have to be vulnerable. Well, the truth of the matter is part of the human condition, we are going to be, whether we like it or not, there are times when we are going to be forced to be vulnerable, and you can't just say, well, I'm not going to do that. I mean, because it's something that you know, you're just going to have to do. There's another myth that vulnerability is about oversharing, and it's not about oversharing or, you know, telling too much of ourselves to someone, because the truth about it is, you know, we should really only be sharing our stories, our, you know, the greatest fears and insecurities, or even those, you know, hopes and dreams, you know, sharing those things with somebody who's earned the right to hear them. Vulnerability minus boundaries is not vulnerability. And the idea that to think that we can go it alone, like I was saying before, like, you know, we can opt out, it's we can't go alone. I mean, life, we are hardwired as human beings to be in connection with each other, neurobiologically wired to be in connection with each other. And so, those are some myths that I think that it's important for people to really begin to understand about vulnerability. It's not weakness.
So let me see if I got that right. You said a myth about vulnerability is that it's about weakness, when in reality it's about courageousness. It's about courage. It's about being authentic and honest about who you are.
Exactly.
And yet, truly, vulnerability is not about oversharing, but it's about finding some safety and some boundaries so that you can share with safe people what's going on inside of you.
Exactly. Because, so have you ever known anyone who you know, just met for the very first time and, you know, all of a sudden they're telling you these intimate details about their life? You know, somebody, a random person in the grocery store, you know, standing at a bus stop or something like that, and someone just, you know, almost just like completely overshared. That's not vulnerability either. I mean, that's really more somebody who's trying to hotwire a connection, and that may be coming from a variety of different, you know, reasons for why somebody would do that. But, so it's, you know, again, I'm gonna say it. Vulnerability without boundaries is not vulnerability. So it is about being able to share and be open and authentic, like you were saying, but it's also doing it with somebody who is safe and somebody who's earned the right to hear our story.
Yeah, I like that you said they've earned the right to be there with you and sit and contain what's going on in your life and know that they're going to keep it confidential, and they're not going to exploit you in any way.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So
I know that, you've got a way to answer this, don't you?
Well, so let me ask you this. Tell me if you think this is someone who's being vulnerable or somebody who maybe trying to hotwire connection or something. So the first one is, do you think that someone who is sharing the intimate details of their child's reaction to your divorce on Facebook, is that person being vulnerable?
Let's see here. My belief is that Facebook is not a good place to share that kind of vulnerability because anybody can read it. And so that person may feel like she's being vulnerable because she is being honest and authentic. But if her ex-husband or her ex-mother-in-law or her nasty neighbor can read that, I just don't think that's healthy vulnerability.
You're right. That's not.
That's okay.
Not. That's someone who has a need to share the story. And again, see, sharing something like that on Facebook, there's no boundaries in that because, like you said, it's open to just whoever could see it, whether it's a neighbor, a juror, or, you know, an ex-husband or something like that. Let me give you another example. Coming home from work to tell your wife that you've just been fired.
I think that is vulnerable. When you come home from work and you tell the person that you love that you've just been fired, that seems open and honest. And I guess the important thing would be to set the scene so that you both feel safe when you do it. You know, if she's in the middle of dishes and she's got a kid there, you're going to want to wait. You're going to want to make sure that you're both ready to hear and deal with the information.
Exactly. And so let me ask you this. Does that seem weak of, you know, if you had to come home, if a husband had to come home and tell his wife he'd just been fired, is that weak? Or what do you think that takes to be able to do something like that?
Well, I think it takes a lot of courage because oftentimes when bad things happen to us, it can feel natural and normal to want to isolate and to keep it a secret. And I think anybody who wants to come home and share with their partner something bad that's occurred in their life, that's very courageous.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so you're two for two, Carol. Good for you.
Thank goodness.
How about this? This is a kind of a tricky one for some people, being the first person to say, I love you, in a relationship.
Well, Marie, that actually happened in my very own life. Now, here I'm just sharing this with the whole world. But,
okay.
You know, when I knew that I loved my husband and he had not said that to me yet or first or whatever, I felt it was a safe enough situation to let him know how I felt so that he'd know where he stood with me. So I think that was a vulnerable thing I did, and yet I felt like it was a natural thing to do. It was a healthy thing, and it worked out beautifully, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. But see, here's the thing about it. Being the first person, because you did, there was something at some level that you felt safe enough to be able to say that to him and to be the first one to say that. But the thing that makes this so hard for so many people is not knowing if they're going to respond in kind. Because you really don't know. If you were the first person in a relationship to be the one to say that, it takes an extraordinary amount of courage. But again, that's about, you know, that is, if you want to talk about true intimacy at the deepest level, being able to be the first one to say, I love you in a relationship, risking, because it is about that risk of, are they going to feel the same way? Or am I going to be left kind of hanging here, you know? Or are they going to immediately respond with, oh, I love you too? So you're absolutely right. It takes an extraordinary amount of vulnerability and courage to be able to do that. Okay, here's another one. I've got one more for you, okay? Sharing your feelings of sadness about the recent death of your father with an attractive man at the office you've never spoken to before.
Well, my radar goes up there because sometimes when people are vulnerable with people that they might be attracted to, it serves as a connection field, and it makes them vulnerable to want to look for that intimacy with that person again. So I would say if you don't know the person, even if there's an attraction because he's attractive, it's not vulnerable. It's like it's missing a couple of boundaries.
Exactly. It's that hot wiring of connection.
It sure is. And that brain science you were talking about earlier.
Yeah. That and we're hardwired, and the thing is we're hardwired for connection. I mean, that's just part of the human condition. But if it's, you know, obviously when a person is in mourning and in grief around the loss of a parent or sibling or something like that, and you're automatically kind of in a very vulnerable state, but then, you know, to go and share something with someone at the office that you really don't know very well, it's kind of hotwired, like it's almost like this hungry thing to try to connect with somebody. I would encourage, you know, someone rather than choosing the attractive person at the office you've never spoken with, to finding another friend or someone else that you can talk about your feelings with. Because that's not really true vulnerability in the truest sense of the word, because you really don't, he may be attractive, but what else do you know about this guy other than the fact that he's an attractive man? Not much. So.
Well, and you know, with the partners that we work with, they have been so hurt, and they have been, there's so much self-doubt that's there. And when they meet somebody after discovery or after disclosure that they don't know well and they confide in them, it gets really dicey because, again, they're looking for a connection that they didn't have with their husband or wife, depending on who the partner is. And
right. It's
an unsafe situation. And yet retaliation attraction is never a healthy choice. Never.
Exactly. And it's something it's something I agree with you. It's something that I would caution partners, because I'm, you know, that's part of that when they're in such a vulnerable state. That's why I'm asking. I need that to a support network. What friends do you have? Who are your go-to people that you can talk to about these things? And, you know, if their go-to person prior to discovery or disclosure was their husband, and now they've lost that, they're in an especially vulnerable place. And so it is about helping to get them shored up in that area, if you will, and through encouraging them to, you know, get into some kind of, whether it's a fellowship or a group, or, you know, to get involved with their church or extended family. It's really important because, you know, that piece can add a whole nother layer of complexity to an already really challenging relationship that you're trying to, you know, work with them to help them restore.
Well, 100%. And obviously, these have been some great examples of situations you might find yourself in, and having the clear-mindedness, the clarity, if you will, to know what is healthy and what isn't. And you and I both know, Marie, that when we've got a partner who's been reeling and dealing with discovery and disclosure, they're oftentimes, their brain is not functioning the way it might have in the past, that their executive functioning isn't working,
exactly.
And their brain kind of goes offline. And so
yes. That's
why I think an APSATS-trained therapist or a coach or online support groups are healthy choices to talk about issues that you may be dealing with like-minded people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I, you know, you bring up a really good point, and I don't know what you see in your practice, but, you know, unfortunately there are a lot of therapists, clinical people, even coaches out there who've had absolutely no training whatsoever in treating partners. And yet, without training, they're kind of running into, I think they run into minefields and end up doing more harm than good. And so I think it is important. And I'm glad to know that today, my sense is today, more partners are so much more savvy today than they, you know, because there weren't a whole lot of options not that many years ago, you know, before APSEPs came on the in the field of being able to train people in this work and how to train and help with either counseling or coaching partners through these really challenging times that they're going through. So, yeah, I agree with you. Totally agree with you.
So now, can you explain more about what it means to be vulnerable? How do you help people in your practice, you know, to be more vulnerable?
Well, you know, one of the things, and I think that there's this expression called circular learning. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but I don't know that Brené Brown coined that term, but she uses that a lot. I'm also trained in Brené's work, but she uses that about trying to, you know, reiterating kind of that same point and kind of coming back again and again. And so I'm going to be using some of that here, particularly when it comes to vulnerability. And I'm going to say that vulnerability without boundaries is not vulnerability, and it does not create intimacy. We talked about, you know, a moment ago about, you know, having a stranger coming up and sharing the intimate details about their life and you know, in an attempt to kind of hotwire connection. But that hotwiring connection does not create true intimacy. Being vulnerable is about sharing our intimate stories, desires, hopes, fears, all of those things with somebody that's earned the right to hear our story. And let me say this about that, that earning the right to hear our story. That, you know, that person who has earned the right to hear our story is that person who can sit there in non-judgment without trying to fix us or the situation, right? Somebody that can hear with a And I like that expression, listening in order or hearing in order to understand, you know, and to just sit with us in that. That oftentimes that's one of the best safe person, if you will. That's somebody who has earned the right to hear our story, as opposed to we go and you know, particularly partners who are really in a vulnerable place may go to either a parent or a sibling or brother-in-law or pastor or something, and instead of being met with a compassionate response, in turn what they're met with, well, you should do this, or you need to, you know, and that's the and again, so that really is at the heart of that, someone who's earned the right to hear our story. And unfortunately for a lot of partners that I work with, that's kind of a trial and error thing, because they may find that, you know, their most trusted person, you know, their, whether it was a parent or a pastor or someone, you know, rather than being that person who is going to be compassionate and understanding, that ends up kind of blowing up in their face. But when they come in and they tell me this, it's like, well, you just learned a really valuable piece of information. This may not be, you know, part of what happens with a lot of partners that I work with is they have to find a new tribe of people. Like you said, finding an assets group or, you know, finding a therapist or some kind of a fellowship where they can feel heard and understood without being judged. And this really gets at that heart of that being vulnerable with somebody that's earned the right to hear our story. You know, I think everybody has a pretty deep awareness of how dangerous it is in revealing our stories, our true desires or preferences, particularly to somebody that we really care about. Because if we tell them what we really want, they might leave. Or, you know, they may shut down or withdraw. Or they may say, I'm not going to do that. Confirming that one thing that we feared all along. And so, you know, it's being vulnerable. And I love, Brené Brown talks a lot about, like, if you think of a metaphor for what it means to physically in the body, what it actually feels like to be vulnerable. Beautiful illustration. To be vulnerable is this idea of just opening your heart to another person, right? And when
right.
when it can be received by that other person with an open heart, that is a beautiful thing. But in the process of opening our heart to do that, at the same time, we also have this, I call it this very sinking feeling, this weak in the knees, right? It's like, and it's kind
right.
of in that very weird space, you know, like being kind of stepping out on a limb, being the first person to say, you know, that you love your partner before they've said that to you. And it's kind of in that limbo state of not knowing how it's going to be received and welcomed or not. And so, you know, what my experience tells me, and you may be aware of this as well too, is, you know, if we choose not to be vulnerable, we're assuming that we're, you know, kind of being safe, right? We're not going to be, we're going to withhold our truth. We're not going to be honest. We're not going to be authentic. We're not going to be vulnerable. And the problem with that, by withholding, is that whether it's months, years or decades later, we begin to see the shadow side of that so-called safe decision.
Because anything we do too extreme does not work. And so anybody who's really afraid to share their feelings and emotions is not going to ever get the connection that they need because
mm-hmm.
they're not being their true authentic self. So your point is be your true authentic self, but make sure it's safe. And let's face it, with our population, that can be
yep.
really, really tough. You know, is it safe to begin to move in that direction? So I want to ask you, what keeps us from sharing our true selves with our partner? And I'm really thinking here about our partners that we work with that have been hurt, you know, they've been devastated. What do you see as the stages for this in terms of looking to help a woman decide what are her boundaries so that she'll know when she's safe?
Right. Great question. Thank you. And again, I'm all about safety. I talk about safety. Well, there's not a day that goes by that I don't talk about safety. And so for me, part of that work is helping my partners come up with the answer to that question. What do you need to feel safe in this particular relationship? And I look at all of the various domains that are involved in that. Emotional safety, psychological safety, physical, spiritual, financial, relational, sexual. This is not, and this work around the safety piece of this, Carol, this is not like done in one or two sessions. I mean, this is an ever-evolving assignment, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I think
I guess.
Early recovery, you know, physical safety, you know, we're the obvious things, you know, in terms of, you know, testing and, you know, sometimes I've had someone in earlier this week, you know, the physical safety, you know, maybe he violated her at night while she was sleeping and that she wasn't aware, but that came out in the disclosure or something. You know, so what are some things that partner would need in order to feel safe just being in the house, right? But looking at developing a list, and I'm really big on, I'm really big on putting pen to paper because I think that we can have things rattle around in our head. I'm in the South, so we say until the cows come home. but when we actually put pen to paper and write things down, I think people get a better idea that they're able to get more clarity about specific behaviors that can be operationalized, as I say. So it's not like, okay, to feel safe with him, I have to be able to trust him. Well, that's too broad. I don't know. What does trust mean to you? Because trust to you might mean something very different to me. And so that's why I work on helping partners develop a list of items that will help them feel safe. I remind them that, like, in the very beginning, you know, they may have only a couple of things on there as they go along. They're going to be adding things because life happens, right? New things come up and something that or now may become an issue that needs to be added to the list, and being able to ask your partner to honor that in order for you to feel safe and to stay in the relationship. I also say, though, that something that's on the list in early recovery, you know, 6, 9 months, year and a half out, may not be as important. So, like, for example, you know, in terms of feeling emotionally, physically, every which way safe, they may have an expectation that their partner or their husband is going to go to, you know, whatever it is, 3 or 4 or 5, whatever, recovery meetings per week, and work with their sponsor and work the steps. Well, you know, a year and a half, 2 years in, they may not, you know, they may not necessarily need to be going to a meeting 3, 4, 5 times a week, right? So that could come off. It could be modified. Do you see where I'm saying? So it's just kind of depending on where a partner is, that list of feeling safe in the relationship, that's how you begin to reestablish trust, connection, and eventually joy in the relationship.
I want to say that I really like the fact that you keep circling around to the partner self-growth and their self-care, because, you know, I just had a woman today right before the show, and she said, you know, I want him to stop flirting. I want him to stop talking to waitresses as long as he does. I want him to stop taking double looks. He is not even aware that he does this. I talked to him about it, and he says, what? I'm not doing all that. Well,
right.
If he sees it, my guess is he's in denial and does not either want to acknowledge that he's doing it or isn't at that place where he can acknowledge it. Regardless, I said to her, I said, you know what? What can you do to keep yourself safe when that happens? Because clearly she goes into a state of panic and anxiety, and you
sure
keep circling around to that. So I'm so happy that you get our clients to look at what can they do for their
exactly
own self-growth and development. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And really looking at all of those domains, you know, one thing is particularly around this financial piece. I had a client in earlier who said that her husband had said to her that he had heard in an SA meeting from one of the attendees that one of the things that he did was to sign a document that if he steps out of the relationship again and is back in his addiction again and she files for divorce, that he walks away, he will not fight, and there will not be a fight about money. He basically loses everything. And her when he said this to her, her first response was, oh, well, why would you do that? You know, she didn't. And what I explained to her is I said, well, what your husband has heard is from another addict, his desire to create safety, financial safety for his wife and family. And he is willing to basically say, how else do you put one's life on the line, right, if you would, but certainly around the financial piece of it. And for a partner to be able to have the freedom to be able to ask for something like that.
That's a wonderful safety net, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, because is that not one of those things that for a lot of partners that they are, you know, that's one of the reasons that many of the women that I work with, that's why they stay, is because they don't have that financial freedom. Now, you know, the challenge is about being, okay, so, you know, if a partner were to have something like that on her list and ask for something like that, and what would that be met with? I mean, the very thing that she fears more than anything else is he would leave. Well, you have to weigh that. So then it's like if you can't ask for that, fear around what his response would be to that, then the work becomes, so what are you going to do to turn around your financial dependence on him?
And, you know, that is, again, the key. It's getting yourself mm-hmm. as financially safe as you can or creating that. So interesting you said that, because one of the last things she said when I was talking about self-growth and self-care, she said, you know what, I really think I'd like to go back to school, and I believe that I'm going to talk to him about that. And
great.
So obviously, when she goes back to school, if she goes back to school, she will be feeling more financially confident. She'll be feeling better about herself, and she'll be doing something that she loves, because you and I both know that this takes a toll on their emotional ability to know their own strengths. They start to doubt themselves, and we don't want partners to do that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you, what do you think are some things that some things to look for in our partners, since in a way, partners are starting over and redeveloping that trust?
You cut out just a little bit there, Carol. Say that again.
Yeah. Well, you identified this a little bit when you were answering the question, but I want to know, what are some things to look for with our clients when they're starting and over? What would you tell them to look for? Because they're really learning how to trust again. And what should they look for? What are the positive signs, and what are the markers for problems?
Right. Well, again, it's about that being, you know, identifying somebody who has earned the right to hear our story. So when you think about that person, are they somebody, are they a person that, and listen without judgment? Are they someone that does what they say and says what they are going to do, right? If they tell you, you know, if one of the things that you request is that I just need to know where you are, that, like, when you're leaving the office, you know, if you're going to stop at the grocery store or something like that, that you let, you know, I mean, staying in touch, their ability to do that or not. And so for me, I use the word, I mean, essentially, because that's really kind of how I conceptualize it. They're collecting data about this new person, because this person is a new person, because the person prior to discovery or disclosure is one person. And now they are getting to know this person that they thought was one person who is not. And so a lot of that has to do with consistency. Are they showing up the way that they say that they, you know, they will? Do they make a commitment to do something and honor that commitment? Are they, when they say they're going to a meeting, are they at a meeting? Are they okay with having the tracker on their phone? Or do they, you know, are they being met with that, you can't tell me what to do, I'm not going to, you know. I mean, you're going to find out, my experience working with partners and addicts, you're going to find out pretty quickly the ones that are really committed to recovery and the ones that have absolutely no interest in changing. And, you know, and so assuming that those, you know, behaviors are consistent, reliable, and that, you know, there aren't any other big surprises in there. Not that things are going to go perfectly. I mean, people have flat tires or, you know, I mean, life happens and gets in the way. You know, even like the example you were using about the, you know, the husband who is in such denial about his, you know, behavior in terms of looking at women or, you know, flirting with waitresses or, you know, whatever, thinking that she is going to be able to kind of move something like that, again, his willingness to be open himself, be vulnerable to change himself, is a big indicator. Because if there's any kind of resistance to that, or to staying in denial, or, you know, kind of same old song and dance, but, you know, nice for a few weeks, but then gets back into some of those old behaviors pretty quickly. Again, I tell partners, you're in the process right now of collecting data. And, you know, that data is going to inform you in terms of who this person is. And if they are genuinely open to change and willing to take risks and be vulnerable and not be right, but as you and I both know, there's plenty of addicts that say, they say one thing and yet they do another. They've been lying all along. They've become pretty masterful at that and the deception. But I think as long as, a partner can stay in a place of at least being open enough to collect data based on the, what they see, what, their experiences, earn the right to hear their story, earn the right for them to be vulnerable with. And until then, I would just say, you're in a watch and see place. I have no expectations of partners, even in early recovery. And I would say early recovery is the first 3 to 6 months. I mean, I had a partner this morning saying, what you have to understand is even me asking for help around the house, I have to be vulnerable to do that because it's quite possible he's going to say no. And if he says no, then how do I, and I'm like, I get it. But if you ask for help and it's not met with, oh, absolutely, or here, let me just, a lot of initiative starts to take place, right? That's great data.
Absolutely.
But if you get the, no, I'm not taking out the trash. No, I am not feeding the dog. No, I'm not going to clean up after dinner. No, I'm not going to give the kids a bath. No, I'm not going to, that's your stuff to do. Again, it's data and it's information and with which they can, then make some decisions about where they're going to go with the relationship.
Well, and so now you just gave us some great examples of obviously a couple where the addict is not working. He's not willing to, what I call negotiate and compromise what they both would like in the relationship. And you and I both know that that's instrumental. John Gottman says negotiation and compromise is imperative.
Absolutely.
In a healthy relationship. So now moving back to the intersection between vulnerability and intimacy, when do you think that intersection occurs? I mean, at what point can a woman begin to see, wow, I think I can trust him?
Well, I think it will always, number one, first and foremost, it always starts with boundaries. If the partner can maintain clear, simple boundaries, right? And remember, boundaries are intended to keep us safe. Healthy boundaries in regards to vulnerability simply mean that we are vulnerable with people that have earned the right to hear our story. So again, it's kind of coming back again. If the addict respects the boundaries that we have set, then that's trading reliability. We do what, they do what they say they're going to do and vice versa. There's somebody who listens without judgment or trying to be right or one-upping or, well, yeah, you're telling me I did that. Well, yesterday you did that, this kind of a thing. But, the person who, again, it's really demonstrating signs of maturity, quite frankly, in a pretty simple way. But it's a person who they can hold steady even when things are rough. They can sit with the discomfort in a tough conversation, right? This is also known as kind of holding that tension, right? Staying in the conversation, listening in order to understand rather than shutting down or running away or, walking out of the room and slamming the door. It's practicing non-judgment by cultivating a heart of curiosity rather than judging the other person. And I, when I'm working with my partners and I do couples work as well, if I had two things I would say to a couple, if you want to know where I begin to notice that things make a difference in a couple's relationship, intentional they are themselves and how they show up in the relationship and how curious they continue to remain about that seeking to understand, right?
Right.
If there was a hurt or there was some kind of an injury that occurred, being open and vulnerable enough to be curious instead of staying in there. And I'm not saying deny your feelings because I would never say that. But can you set your feelings aside just for a moment to try to seek to understand why, he did what he did or didn't do what he didn't do, right? And I mean, and again, testing the veracity of that with, if it's the same old thing over and over and over again, always late because of this or that or the other, or if it, if there's some genuineness there. And again, I think that I mentioned this before, this idea of being able to hold space for the other person while they're being vulnerable. It just simply means to actively listen to the other person without judgment, not trying to fix them, to correct them, offer advice, simply being present for your partner. And it's hard. I don't know what your experience, Carol, but a lot of men are, you know, fixers. You know, I just want to fix it. So being able for them, you know, and for some women, that's what they want. They want, you know, they want a solution to the problem. But there's more people that I know, particularly partners, they just want to be heard. You know, it was a long day with these kids, or oh my god, and da 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 da, da and this happened, and this, you know, just someone who can sit there and attentively listen to them and hold space for them, and being willing to keep a loving position despite differences and show that love through curiosity rather than judgment. There's this process called self-differentiation, and it's comprised of three parts, and together these three parts make up a healthy, emotionally mature adult. The first part is becoming able to figure out what you think, feel, need, and prefer. This goes back to that whole self-awareness piece. Number two is being able to share it with another person. Three, becoming able to remain grounded and present when your partner shares something vulnerable about themselves that you may not be comfortable hearing. And so
that
this,
makes
this
total
is
what, sense.
Right?
Yes. I love that. So obviously that helps somebody decide, are partners meeting the criteria to make us feel safe, and do they show good emotional maturity? And I think you referenced it earlier, IQ.
Yeah. Emotional quotient. Yeah.
And,
you know,
you have given us so much good information. How can people get a hold of you if they want to work with you or talk with you further about vulnerability and intimacy?
Well, people are more than welcome to go to my website, which is just www.mariekrebsconsulting.com, boy S, just one B. They can send me an email at marie@mariekrebsconsulting.com. Or if they want, they can phone me at 469-212-9897.
Yeah, again, Marie is an APSATS-trained therapist. Obviously, you are a wealth of information on vulnerability and intimacy, and I love the boundaries piece. Like you said, that is the foundation for rebuilding trust. So thank you.
Absolutely.
So much. And we got to have you back on the show. You just are an amazing communicator.
You're so sweet, Carol. Well, I have high regard for you and the work that you do, and particularly in our community and educating partners and others that work in our field. And I'm just very grateful for you and the work that you do. And thank you for having me on the show.
All right. You take care and make it a good week.
Thank you, Carol. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So that, again, that was Marie Krebs, and she gave you all that information, and she's a storehouse of knowledge, APSATS trained and one of the best. So I really appreciate her coming on and talking about vulnerability. If you want to read about vulnerability, get any of Brené Brown's books, because obviously that is what she trains herself in. So thank you for joining us today. Thanks for having the courage to want to know how to stay safe and stable. And we will see you next week. And as I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times. So fearlessly have the courage to be yourself.
For more information, go to APSATS.org, the Association of Partners of Sex Addicts Trauma Specialists, to find a professional in your area who is trained to help you after sexual betrayal.